Today, inflation, deflation, confusion. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, World's Latest Post, covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined again by Steve Van Meter. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Martin.
Good to see you again. Thanks very much for coming back on the show. Congratulations on all the coverage you're getting. You're certainly getting your messages out there, and great that you've got time to come back and talk to me some more.
Well, thank you. Yes, it's been very exciting since I very first came onto your show, and it seems to have just grown like wildfire since. And I think you said before the show, definitely the DFA effect. So I'm glad to be back and always have time for you and your viewers.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. And there's a very interesting little phrase called the inflation fairy tale, which I think will be a good place to start. We discussed last time the inflation deflation discussion, which, you know, frankly, is a pretty important discussion because it determines a whole bunch of things, including asset allocation and strategies and all those things. And I think that debate is really hotting up.
To say the least, it's probably the biggest argument going on in the financial services industry among professionals, investors, and even everyone else.
Yeah, it's fascinating how, a few months ago, I guess most people were simply saying, well, there's massive amounts of inflation and it's all going to, you know, go a particular direction. But now there's sort of cross currents and it's quite interesting to try and navigate. Now, last time after our show, I had a whole bunch of people throw me questions, right? So what I'd like to do is to boil back those questions into two or three different conversation points. And the first one is, when you say inflation, what do you mean by inflation? Because, you know, there's an argument to say inflation is just basically a bigger money supply. And to give you an example, in Australia, the broad money is now 11% higher than it was a year ago. So on that definition, you could say inflation is 11%. But then if you look at the CPI, it's much lower. How do you actually think about defining inflation?
Right. I look at inflation as the year-over-year rate and change in the consumer price index. And just like in Australia, the broad money here is up like 25% year-over-year or something absurdly ridiculous like that. Now, going back in time, we can go back to, when Friedman was around and he was looking at this, the money supply did have a relationship with inflation. And there's a very simple view of why people kind of get that wrong, but they need to understand what the money supply means and then how it can create inflation. So let me just first come back to what obviously inflation is in my world. Now, obviously that not everyone's going to agree with this, but I'm looking at the year over year rate of change in the consumer price index, which in the United States, because we are an importing nation, is, especially particularly from China and a lot of Asian nations, when we see goods and services come over, if those goods and services are increasing in price and increasing at a rapid rate relative to the year before, then we should see inflation. Now, how does the money supply, myth get involved in that? Well, it's really quite simple. Savings is deferred spending. So, for example, let's say I'm going to buy a car in a few years and I want to reduce my payment since I'm going to finance it, I can save money up and then I can come down and put a down payment on it or a vacation or anything else, that or TV. It's deferred spending. So the logic is when you see all this money piling up, broad money piling up, well, where is it mostly showing up? In checkings and savings accounts. And then in the third arena, you see what's called institutional money funds, which for most people, if they are not familiar with that phrase, think of it as your qualified retirement accounts, your brokerage accounts, that cash position. That's generically referred to as institutional money funds. Now, if you've got money in your 401k, you don't think of that as like, oh, that's spendable. I'll just go pull that out and spend it. It's just part of your asset allocation. So if we focus strictly on the checking and savings aspect of this, you see this just massive buildup in broad money. And so the natural assumption people have is, okay, at some point, Steve, Martin, and everyone else are gonna run out with all that money and start spending it. They're gonna eat up all of the inventory that's in the market. And because there's a shortage and there's, you know, people are out of work and factories are idle-ish, that all of a sudden there aren't going to be enough goods and services to meet that surge in demand. And you're going to see an astronomical rise in consumer prices. But we're not seeing that.
Yep. Absolutely. And I guess it's worth saying that the definition of CPI as officially published, you know, has changed over the years, and they've taken out property and all other things. So some people will argue that the official CPI rate is probably understating if you calculate it on the old basis where we are. But, you know, that's a bit of an arcane argument. We are where we are in terms of the way that the CPI is measured and therefore how the Fed is actually positioning against it. So, but I tend to agree that looking at the broad money and sort of imputing an inflation rate from that is just too simplistic. So thank you for explaining that. I guess the second point then is, you know, we said that also that the critical question is, will people borrow? Because essentially you need a rate of change in credit to increase to be able to drive inflation and everything else, right? Because of the multiplier effects and all of those things. And certainly in Australia, we're seeing total credit basically going down rather than up at the moment, despite ultra low interest rates. And you made the point that actually really low rates doesn't necessarily translate to more credit activity.
No, not at all. And so even here in the United States, I look at the 3 and 6 month data, whereas the government publishes a year over year, but I download the data and dissect it. And on total loans and leases at all commercial banks over a 3 and 6 month period, we're in contraction. And that, you know, for your viewers, what that means, if you see the 3 months start to contract and then the 6 months start to contract, well, guess what? The tail on the 12 months, which is way out there, that means it's coming down. And in a debt-based economy, you need people to borrow to create money, as you said, to multiply it throughout the system. And that ultimately leads to inflation. But one of the big challenges is, at least here in the United States, is we have 26.5 million people on unemployment. And the problem is, I don't know a bank that lends to people on unemployment. And I don't know people that are on unemployment that specifically want to run out and borrow. So you see this, you know, again, stack up in the broad money, and you have to ask yourself, where is it going to go? Why are people saving money? Well, some people have been saving it up because they knew my job is gone. It's not coming back. I got to go find another one, and I better save. Plus the other factor that so many people miss, and you'll have to tell me if Australia is doing this, and I imagine they are to some degree, is we have a lot of loans in deferment. So a lot of those loans were deferred for 6 months. And I understand that some government insured mortgages can go here even as long as 12, but we haven't seen all those loans come out of deferment yet. So if I'm on unemployment back during the pandemic and I'm making more money than I made and I can't spend it and I've got all my loans in deferment and I get fired or lose my job, what am I thinking? Well, gee, at some point I got to make that mortgage payment, car payment. I got to make all those payments. I better save money. But there's this notion that all these people are going to run back to the workforce. There's going to be jobs everywhere. They're going to get hired on, and then they're going to have all the spendable money, and then boom, it's going to hit the economy and just cause an explosion. Well, of inflation is just not going to happen at all. The demand just doesn't exist. And that is probably the biggest factor that I think people are missing, is you can't just get inflation because you want it. In a debt-based economy, as Martin, as you just said, you need people to borrow money to create new money in the system, and that money needs to move around and exchange hands. And then the faster it exchanges hands and the more money is lent into existence, now you get inflation. Well, what are we seeing? The exact opposite. We're seeing money moving we're slower than molasses, and you're seeing banks with lending standards as tight or almost as tight as they were here during the great financial crisis. That's not a recipe for inflation. In fact, that is the recipe for deflation.
Well, it's interesting here because over the last few weeks, a few things have happened. They've basically announced that they're going to take away what they call the responsible lending rules. In other words, it's going to be freer for people to borrow than currently. March next year is when that's going to come in. So they're taking away consumer protection to try and actually get people to borrow more. That might be a sign of desperation. And we also have the same situation where we have a whole bunch of loans in deferment around 11-12% of mortgages currently are actually in deferment. A higher proportion of SME loans in deferment now. They will have to come back on channel in due course. The question is precisely when. There are various techniques like moving to interest only to try and reduce repayments and all those things. But the banks are having to call individuals and talk to them about what they're going to do over the next few months. So by March next year, that's got to be sorted. So that's another sort of downward force. And then the other factor is the savings ratio here is very, very high. But we also can see a lot of people are repaying debt. And in a time of uncertainty, it makes sense to repay debt because, you know, debt can be a noose around your neck in a situation where, as you say, you lose your job or, you know, other personal circumstances change. So in a way, all of the behavioral forces and even the confidence levels, which are very low, are also suggesting borrow less, not borrow more. And yet the government and the banks are trying to sort of force more borrowing into the system. But, you know, unless people want to drink from the fire hose, it doesn't make any difference.
Yeah, and it makes perfect sense of, you know, why would, let's just say I was one of the fortune that kept my job. You know, obviously, well, I must be, because here we are talking. and even though some people think I'm in my parents' basement, this is actually just a very old office with a lot of wood paneling. But why would I save money is because if I'm a business owner or I work for somewhere, I have to be feeling that my job potential is at risk and maybe my income's at, maybe my job's not at risk, but maybe that bonus or maybe I'm going to cut an income or benefits. So what's the smartest thing I can do to hedge? Pay off debt. And so you just have this massive transfer between the government to the public, and all the government's doing is just taking on more and more debt, and it's not creating economic growth. And that's the weak side. Now in America, I look at when our loans really started massively going into deferment was in May, which means November, December, which, you know, as you know, Martin, very critical holiday season. And what a lot of viewers need to understand, now some who are on deferment already know this, but for those who aren't, some government insured mortgages, depending on where you're at in the world, will let you take those missed payments and move them all the way to the end of the mortgage or the debt. Your other debt doesn't work that way. It's called a lump sum. So the deferment was, we'll give you some time to make the payment, but on this date, you owe us, say, those 6 months plus the seventh. Well, that's going to be a massive whammy to a lot of financial budgets, especially around the holiday season. And to me, it's recipe for disaster.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Well, we've got rental payment deferrals as well currently in train. And it's very interesting that when I survey those who are paying or not paying the rents that they normally would pay, there is complete confusion in their minds as to whether those rental payments have purely been deferred. In other words, as you say, there will be a requirement to pay it back later, or whether it's been just, you know, not, you will never have to repay them. It's completely unclear. And that's another reason why the level of uncertainty here in Australia is very high amongst the renting sector. One of the reasons why rents are going down, and a lot of property investors are now scratching their heads thinking, well, I can't get the returns on property investment. So, you know, all of these factors, and this is real world stuff. And what I like about our conversation, Steve, is we actually get into the real world, in the real economy, how real people are behaving, rather than these sort of theoretical discussions around inflation and deflation, right? Because that's a consequence of what people are doing or not doing.
Yeah, I mean, there's a very simplistic way to look at inflation and deflation. If there is less demand, prices go down. And you see, like you just said, in the rental market, I mean, we didn't even touch on the fact, what if my sole income is as a landlord, but what if I have, you know, 30 properties and none of them are paying rent? I mean, maybe they're okay, but how long am I okay? I mean, there's all these other mitigating factors that people can't see. Is we can't have things being in deferment forever. Banks can't handle that forever. At some point, the music's got to stop. People have to start paying, and it's going to be brutal. And the whole notion that all this money is going to flood out to discretionary goods and services, to me, is baffling. I mean, there's just going to be no demand. Now, will there be demand in certain areas? Sure, you know, there'll be demand for food and other things that will probably go up in price. But on the other end of the spectrum, there'll be a lot less demand for, say, new cars. And those prices and other things, or travel, will go down. It's just the way the world works, unfortunately.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. And, you know, the world is made up of individuals making decisions, but in a context, right? And for many people, their financial position is less secure than it was, their incomes are less secure than it was. And despite all of the government, stimulus, we had a budget this week with a massive amount of government borrowing being thrown into the economy via businesses mostly. you know, but it doesn't necessarily translate to the outcome that perhaps people are aspiring to. Now, one of the other questions I wanted to touch on, though, Steve, was your comment, and you know, people here didn't quite get it, I think, that basically when that asset swap happens between the Fed and the banks, right, you said that the regulations are that they can't really use that money that's sitting in the Fed's accounts for the banks. Can we just unpack that a bit more? Because I'm not sure that people got it.
Okay, sure. Let's kind of just start at the beginning for those who maybe didn't hear that episode or new to DFA. Is when the Fed engages in quantitative easing, they take a reserve asset from the bank, which is either a U.S. Treasury security or mortgage-backed security, and they swap it with an overnight security. Now, on onset, people say, well, it's money printing. Well, you have to understand that Treasury security and mortgage-backed security that was held in reserve by the bank is removed from the financial system. We account for it on the Fed's balance sheet, but it's not like you can call up the Fed and say, hey, I'd like to buy that. No, it effectively is removed from the system. So it's just a swap. And if you look at the balance sheet at the bank, you'll see a swap. It's still a reserve asset. So now this cash asset that the banks receive, which is, now here's the key part. It goes and sits at a Federal Reserve member bank. It doesn't get paid to the bank as cash. It goes to a Federal Reserve member bank and it sits there. It's locked away. Now, there's only three things that that reserve asset can do. It can move around the system. For example, let's say, Martin, you're a bank and I'm a bank and I have a reserve asset from QE. You have a Treasury security. And for whatever reason, we both really want what each other has for some reason or another. We can swap those because what is it? It's just a record change. It just says, hey, this reserve asset went from Steve's bank to Martin's bank, and it didn't leave the system. It didn't leave the Federal Reserve member bank where it's housed. So that's the first thing. The second thing it can do, it can be used as collateral against a loan. But again, coming back to the key part, it can't leave the system. So if a bank wants to lend against it, which is what the Fed wants, the banks have to risk their own capital, because if the loan defaults, that doesn't, it's not like that pays out, it's stuck there. And the borrower has to risk their collateral. Well, right now, banks don't want to risk their capital, and borrowers are probably in the same boat with that. And then the third way they can be used is they can be used as a deposit when the primary dealers bid on U.S. Treasury auctions. So if anyone's ever been to an auction, and especially if it's a large, you know, if the asset you're buying are big enough, there's usually some sort of down payment that you have to post to bid, because they don't want you coming in and bidding $1 million properties without thinking that you can actually buy it. So the primary dealer banks can post these as deposits, bid on treasury securities at the auction, and then they settle the debt later on, just like as any auction would. And those are the three phases of those reserve assets. But the key is they cannot leave the system. They never leak out. And that's what makes it not money printing.
Yep. And that's very well explained. Thank you very much for that, Steve. And I should add that, you know, here in Australia, what's happening at the moment is that the RBA here is providing very cheap funding to the banks, much cheaper than they can get from the bond market. And so what's happening in Australia is that the banks are actually basically taking that cheap funding and then trying to do loans and then repaying bonds that were previously in existence. So effectively, again, there is a swap between one type of assets than another. It doesn't necessarily increase the total sort of volume, if you like, that the banks have here. But what it does do is it drops the price, because what the Reserve Bank here is doing is trying to control the yield curve. It's trying to drop the yield curve to force through lower, cheaper funds into the banks to get them to lend more cheaply, right? But then
You said it exactly. So if we actually went back, and just so your viewers know, there are differences between the Fed and the Australian Central Bank. I mean, they may not be major, but there are differences. But what is the purpose of all of these central bank mechanisms? No matter which one you go look at, why are they doing all of this? For one reason, to lower interest rates. And why do we want lower interest rates? Well, it's simple. If we need to get people to borrow, to create money, to get it to move around the system, will higher interest rates work? Nope. Unfortunately, people right now will only want to borrow if rates are low, because, you know, let's say I have a mortgage of 3.5% and mortgage rates went to, we'll just say 7%. Why would I refi? And if I did, why would I cash money out? I absolutely would not do that. Now, if it went to one, I'm like, oh, well, you know, I needed to, you know, pull out some money to replace my air conditioner or put my new fence up. Different story. So yeah, low rates is the whole purpose of all of this central bank funny stuff.
Yeah, and that's the key point that people, I think, again, are missing, right? This is about controlling the yield curve, driving rates down, trying to make loans cheaper. That's why there's been a massive refinancing exercise. So a lot of people with existing loans are going to the bank and negotiating down the rate because the rates are now lower. But that doesn't necessarily increase the total volume of credit. What it's doing is compressing, if you like, the returns that the banks are getting. And so there's a lot of pressure now on margins in the banks because effectively the funding's lower, but the loans are now also yielding lower returns. And that's one of the critical issues that people need to understand. As rates come lower, bank profitability gets crushed. And by the way, that often leads ultimately to them lending less, not more.
Well, absolutely, because the whole notion there is if you know, let's say, Martin, I need money, and you say, well, Steve, I'll loan you some money. So great, I'd like 2% for 30 years. You're going to say, well, I might like it, but there's no way I'm going to take that risk. And you know, the banks don't want to do that either. And, you know, this whole notion that lower interest rates are inflationary is a massive fallacy, because the whole point of lowering interest rates is to get people to borrow money. But there has to be an opposite reaction. So if borrowing money creates money in the economy, well, there has to be a mechanism to make it go away. It has to be destroyed. And what people don't realize is when a principal payment on a loan is made. So if you look, say, at any loan and you have interest and then you have principal, any part of your principal payment that comes back is destroyed from the financial system. So if I have a 0% loan, every payment I make is destroying money, which is leading to risking a contraction in credit. So there has to be such a massive volume in new loans created every day to offset all these payments, because as soon as people refi, now they're paying more principal. And yeah, the whole thing, you know, as I said before, is zero interest rates are the death of the monetary system, because you can't create enough new loans fast enough to offset the destruction of money. And then the central banks just don't have the tools and abilities to offset that, and you get a recession. I mean, it's just the natural way things work.
Right. And just to underscore that, what we're saying is when loans are repaid, that's deflationary.
Correct.
Yeah. And that's what, that again.
Anytime, you know, so if you got a stimulus check from a government and you said, you know what, I'm going to go make a big payment on my credit card, put $1,000 on that, to the principal, you just, that $1,000 the government borrowed was just destroyed when you made that payment. And now the government's on the hook, not only to pay interest on that, but to pay that loan off, you know, whatever, in whatever terms they borrowed it. So it actually is deflationary, because money was destroyed and now we have a debt that requires more money to keep it serviced by the interest cost.
Yeah, absolutely right. Now, the last thing I want to touch on today, Steve, is bonds, your favorite subject, but boy, it's a bit interesting at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, third bond route this year, interest rates have gone up for the third time. Finally, everyone's talking about how this is it. This is the big signal. Interest rates are going to go straight up. And what's interesting, in fact, I just did a whole show on this today about the speculative positioning in the U.S. Treasury market is at its all-time record short position. Not by a little bit, not by that much. I mean, by off the charts. This thing is so bad that everybody's betting against the bond market. And what I love about markets is when they're offside, when you have this out of balance, you know, it'll get way out of balance, and then the big players come in and just clean everybody's clock. And so right now we're seeing, again, another bond route, everyone shorting U.S. Treasuries, and they're really betting against the Fed, because we're seeing credit contraction, and that doesn't lead to higher interest rates. Stimulus isn't being stimulative. Government borrowing doesn't create inflation, and QE leads to lower interest rates. So effectively, everybody's betting against the Fed, and eventually the Fed will keep coming along, chewing up bonds, and they will trigger a massive short squeeze. And when they do, you know, the world is going to know about it, because it's going to be brutal.
And do you think the timing of that is to do with the election? Do you think it's the fact that they've basically sort of taken the 1-point-something trillion stimulus package off the table, all those factors playing in?
Why people are betting against the bond market? Yep. No, the reason people are betting against the bond market is they believe stimulus is stimulative and they believe QE is stimulative. I mean, it's always the same story, right? It's like, okay, we did, you know, a trillion of stimulus or whatever a number is, and that didn't work. Well, we'll just do 2 trillion because that will do it. Or a trillion of QE, we'll do 2 trillion. The notion is when you put these two things together, stimulus and QE, you have to get inflation. There's no way you can't, because the whole world believes they're inflationary, when in fact, they're not inflationary at all. And if stimulus was inflationary, it would be in the very short term. And if QE was inflationary, we would have seen it by now, because in the US, we've done close to 2 trillion in QE this year. It's still nothing. So yeah, the market is betting big on something happening that is unlikely to happen. And there will be a day they find out they're wrong. And again, it will echo across the world, because they're going to have to get out of those positions, and we're in the middle of a massive dollar shortage. So they're going to go need to get dollars. Dollar's going to rally, and then they're going to get squeezed on their bonds, and bond prices are going to rally. And next thing you know, the whole system's going to just grind to a halt, and the world will know about it.
Well, what's your sense on timing? I mean, is it really going to be, you know, before Christmas, or is it going to go over into next year, do you think? Or is it hard to tell?
You know, I was thinking we would start to see it this month, but there was a big, big push. I mean, again, markets can move real quick. So, sure. I mean, you know, we're still early in October. I really thought it would happen this month, but the sellers just came in just super aggressive, just massively shorting the market and futures, options, every which way possible. So it's inevitable that it's, you know, if it's not this month, well, the next couple of months, because it's, again, you come back to the fact that all these loans come out of deferment. There's going to be a demand for dollars. There's no demand for loans. I mean, all the lending demand we're seeing around the world is, as you said earlier, is not leading to credit growth. I mean, at some point, the system just can't handle it. And driving interest rates up only leads to less credit growth, which ultimately leads to lower interest rates. And it sounds weird, but it's actually how it works. The monetary systems are very flexible. I mean, they will adjust to what's going on, and they want to keep asset prices up. So the monetary system itself will say, look, if you're not going to give me the credit growth that I want, I will shrink asset prices down until I get it. And that means, well, as we've seen in the past, and we'll eventually see again, someday we'll be right. And people will be in disbelief, but in the end, there will be a day when the whole system comes crumbling down.
Yeah, well, you know, being a contrarian as you are, of course, you expect to get all the brickbats at the moment. But you know, the bouquets will follow if, in fact, your perspective is correct. And I'm fascinated by, you know, people like Real Vision and George Gammon and a few other people have all been talking about this. And I actually think this whole debate is getting a bit more mature now, and people are beginning to wake up to some of the nuances. But for a lot of people coming to it first, it really is so different from the way that economics has been taught and most people in central banking land think. So it really is a fascinating contention here at a sort of philosophical level.
Yeah, it is. And a lot of it stems from the fact that people believe the central bankers can do what they say they can do. And it's just a big con game. I mean, sometimes central bankers get lucky. I mean, they get what they need and the economy turns around. But this time, I mean, and if we look back at what everything's supposed to happen, stocks in the U.S. should be just skyrocketing higher every day. I mean, they wanted QE, well, they got it. They wanted stimulus, they got it. You know, why aren't interest rates, you know, higher than they were back in March or in June? They're not. So all this notion is, if we just zoom out and look at what's really going on, the big picture is telling you things are bad. And we did get some economic growth from the, you know, pandemic as inventories were rebuilt, but I'm looking at the data around the world, and I don't know if this is true in Australia, but it looks like it's slowing down pretty fast to me. So I just kind of see the economy rolling over, and the governments are running out of their limit to borrow. I mean, people don't understand there is a limit to what they can do, because the more a government borrows, the more jobs are permanently destroyed. They don't really understand that. And the simple way to look at this, and maybe this is something maybe we can dig deeper into on a later date, because I'm sure you'll get a lot of questions about it. If you think, let's just use the United States as an example. There is a pool of dollars, and every day the government has its appetite that it needs, and then everyone else has to go and fight for their part. there's winners and losers. It's like musical chairs. There are some people who will not get the dollars they need. They will default on the loans. The problem is the government has priority. It will get what it wants. So the more it borrows, the bigger every day it comes in and chews up those dollars, leaving a little bit less for you and I and everyone else. And that is the problem, is because the government's borrowing money and using it for stimulus and everything else, and it's not being stimulative, it's not leading to spending and job creation, it's going to lead to permanent job losses. And that in no possible way is inflationary.
Yeah. So my analogy, Steve, is like this. You're in a room, right? And in that room, there is a balloon, right? And the balloon is being inflated and inflated and inflated, right? But the entire room can't get bigger, which means that you've got less and less space around the balloon as it gets larger. And you get to the point where you're being squeezed against the walls and people get, you know, squashed. That's the analogy that I'm thinking about, because that balloon can be made quite a lot bigger, although there are, you know, limits, but it has an impact beyond it.
Right. And the impact is people realize their jobs aren't coming back. Mm. And then they decide that, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want the government to borrow it. And eventually the economy does collapse in on itself and everyone realizes that none of it actually worked. And then the system sort of resets, so to speak, and it starts over again. I mean, it's just the same thing. The problem is the government debt doesn't reset. And that's the thing that a lot of, especially younger people that are listening to your show, they should, even if they've lost their job, they should not be happy about what's going on, because the more government debt we have, we still have to pay it back. And that means risking, if we do not get inflation, and under the current monetary constraints around the world, we're not going to, but if we don't get it, that means it's called austerity. That means there's going to be long periods of economic malaise where governments are chewing down their debt level until the other side of the economy can expand enough to get going again. And yeah, I'm not a big fan of any of this, but eventually the house of cards shall tumble. The longer we go, as you know, we've talked about, the bigger the fall.
Yeah, absolutely. And it does really underscore the fundamental question, which is, do central banks know what they're doing? You know, are they competent? Are they capable? Or are they basically building a myth and then trying to preach the myth and trying to jawbone people into doing things, right? But actually, really, they know that they're really relatively unable to do the things that they want to do.
Right. The answer is central banks don't have the tools or the mechanisms to do what they need to do, because essentially we have a currency shortage, mainly the major one being the US dollar, because it's the world's reserve currency. Mm. And then if we go below that, we see that there's currency shortages everywhere. Well, one of the key things about central banks is they can't print money. Now, some can, you know, you go to, you know, third world central banks, you go to China, they can actually get away with printing money. Risks, of course, with that. But the general idea is central banks cannot print money. The only way money is created when people borrow. Well, the problem is lower and lower, lower interest rates leads to a more rapid money destruction. And it is a self-fulfilling prophecy that they can't get out of this hole. If they would have just left things alone decades ago, maybe we wouldn't be in this situation. But yeah, the central banks just don't have the tools to do it. And if we give them the tools and everyone's thinking, well, let's print money and all that, great, it'll be fine. Tell yourself that until we do. Go find some, go read a history book on what money printing's like. Ooh, it sounds good until it's not.
Yeah, spot on. And I just go back to Japan, the Eurozone, where they've been at this longer, you know, and those were really very interesting stories, which I can hardly say were successful stories.
Never been a successful story in history, or else we wouldn't have done it by now. I mean, that's the thing that people understand, is central banking hasn't been around 10 years or 20 years. It's been around hundreds of years, and it's never worked. Yep. It's never, the debt-based system has never, ever, ever worked. But if you understand, see, the key thing that people need to understand, though, if you understand a system is prone to failure, and debt-based monetary systems, after so many years, will fail. And if you can position yourself with cash or liquid assets and a low debt load, when that crash eventually comes, you can go buy stuff cheap. Wealth is created in the middle of recessions, not at the top. If you look at how many families around the world, the wealthiest families, not all of them, a lot of them made their money during recessions because they went out and bought out their competition or bought up a bunch of stuff or did things that other people couldn't do. Real estate investors, right? I mean, that's really common. You'll hear, you always hear about how did that person get all of those property? Well, they had a massive amount of cash. They had great credit and they were one of the few people the banks would lend to. And they went and just cleaned house and bought, you know, hundreds of properties. Well, wealth is created at market bottoms, not at market tops. So yeah, there's an opportunity if people can be in a position to take advantage. And if they do, completely change their financial future.
Yeah, and that is the point. And, you know, there are a number of people, including Harry Dent and Robert Kiyosaki, who are basically making that point, right? But you have to watch for the signs and you have to be pre-positioned and not essentially on the wrong side of the argument with regard to inflation or deflation, or you're going to miss out.
Right. You have to understand the system. You have to understand about where we're at. At some point, you place your bets and then you wait. The hardest part of the whole thing is being patient. I mean, I think you and I have agreed that we should have had a recession, a global recession, a couple of years ago. Yep. We haven't. Does that mean we won't? No, it doesn't. It just means those who are waiting have to wait a little bit longer. And when it happens, the opportunities will still come. And there'll probably be more opportunities. But patience is something a lot of humans just don't have. But if you do, it can literally change your future. And I think that's probably, you know, why you do your show and why I do my show, is to let people know, like, look, you don't have to be like everyone else. And it's not being a contrarian. It's just, hey, when you understand the system, you end up being called a contrarian because you're trying to change your financial outlook too. Because if you're in real estate and you own 10 properties and there's another recession and you could triple that for the same price you paid for 10, why wouldn't you? But you get labeled a contrarian along the way. But yeah, opportunity is for the patient.
And I go back to The Big Short, which is one of my favorite all-time films, right? And you know, you just watch the, you know, the guy had the hunch and basically had to sit there and sit there and sit there and take all the abuse for years and years and years until finally.
Well, yeah, and their financials, right? Remember their financial, I mean, they were just getting, I mean, talk about who was getting squeezed, right? Remember when they were calling, are you sure that is the price? It shouldn't be. Yes, we're sure. How can it be? You know, the system's collapsing.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, there is, you know, I sometimes say to people, if you want to understand what's going on, The Big Short is probably one of the best films to watch because it shows the psychology as well as the technicalities, right? And I think that's actually very important here because there is a psychological aspect to this. But as you say, being patient and actually holding to your course when all about you, others are going in a completely different direction is probably one of the hardest things to do.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean if everyone, just because everyone's going left, you should go right. It means you should study the system, you know, listen to shows like DFA and learn how the machine works. So that way you can position yourself correctly, you know, manage your debt load. I mean, you know, there's just fantastic stories about, you know, people who live very, very modestly, well below their means, you know, while their friends were buying homes and cars, oh, what's wrong with you? And then the recession hits and they just mop up and change everything. I mean, that is just so hard to do because, well, hey, spending money's fun.
Absolutely. We're programmed to do that. But sometimes there's a bigger set of questions to ask. Steve, look, I've really enjoyed your conversation with me today. Thank you very much for spending time with us and once again helping to clarify some of those really critical issues. We'll talk again soon, I guess, as this situation continues to, you know, grind forward. And I'll be watching those bonds like a hawk.
Martin, it's always a pleasure, and I'm always happy to come back anytime you want. And yeah, so last time we talked about watch for 30-year yields to break 1.2. Now we watch for the third peak to get reversed. So I think the third time's the charm. We'll find out maybe the next time we talk.
I look forward to it. Thanks, Steve. Have a great day. Cheers.
Cheers. Thanks, Martin.